And welcome to this week's edition of Legal Line. This is Bob Pittman. Glad to have you with me this week as we start our weekly venture into the mysterious realm of the law. We try each week to demystify the law, translate the legalese, and hopefully point you in the right direction with regard to your legal problems, and this week is no exception. Of course, we have one ground rule, and that is that we don't like to mention actual names. That's a funny rule, isn't it? But, yeah, it's not the purpose of the program to do an expose or blast a particular individual or company. So we'll try to keep that in mind when we're talking about your legal problems. And, of course, I wouldn't be an attorney if I didn't have a disclaimer or limitation of damage clause attached to the program. You have to get up kind of close to see it, but if you do, you'll find that it tells you that damages resulting from advice given on this program strictly limited to what you paid for the advice. Wouldn't you know it? Leave it to the lawyers to come up with this stuff, and we do. And we do. Hey, plan to give us a call each Wednesday, 3 p.m. Pacific time. We're going to be turning our clocks back pretty soon, at least back out here in Washington, most parts of the country. I think it's the second. It must be like the first Sunday of the month in November, isn't it? Come to think of it. But coming up soon, so keep track of that so you'll be on time when you tune in on Wednesday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific time. Plan to give us a call at 253-471-9694. Of course, you can always visit us at bobpittman.com. Be sure to check out the Legal Line archive. We've got all the programs that we have done so far, and we'll continue to do that, listed at the archive, so you can listen to an old program, new program, whatever, check it out. Look for a particular one. We had a question the other day. I said, hey, Bob, I thought you had talked to the neighbor law lawyer. Well, yep, the neighbor law is one of my favorite books, by the way. It is at our recommended reading list, which is also at bobpittman.com. You can find it on the Legal Line page. But the neighbor law author, Emily Dosko, is terrific, and it's a fun little interview with her, so look for that in the Legal Line archive. Of course, we have our blog up and running and commentary going on there. Hey, before we get started, we've got a question Diane's going to help us with, but before we get going, I just want to remind us all of the importance of the judicial elections. I know a lot of people kind of yawn and say, oh, I don't know, you know, judges. But, you know, they do an awful lot of important stuff, whether we like them or not. They affect our lives all the time. Our daily lives are affected by the judges that we elect. We vote on our judges in Washington State. There are some people who would like to change that, of course, and make it so that we don't vote our judges in. I'm a proponent. I like the fact that we elect our judges, but I think we have an obligation to do a little bit of homework and think about what we're doing when we go in, and whether we go to the poll and actually vote, or if we do it like I do it with the absentee ballot, you know, drawing that little line in between the the name and the office. Anyway, whether we do it that way or we do it actually in the poll, the voting booth, we need to educate ourselves a bit about judges. And it has always been hard to figure out how to vote for judges and how to get information. I found a terrific website that is available here in Washington. If you're in a different state, you got to find out from your bar association what's out there. But it is just terrific. The website address is votingforjudges.org. One word, voting for judges, F-O-R, not the number four, votingforjudges.org. We have it listed at our links page at the website. So you can go to the Legal Line page and look for links. And in the links section, there's a whole bunch of fun stuff there, by the way. But if you go to the Voting for Judges link, then you'll end up at this really fun website. And it's, again, votingforjudges.org. But you can look, and as you look at that, you'll find a place where you can show your election. So if you tap on that, You get a map of the state, and you can then tap on your county, and you'll get a list of the judges who are running in that county, in addition to the big ones like the Supreme Court. And, of course, we do have a Supreme Court race. But if I tap on Pierce County, I'm going to see, Jim Johnson is unopposed, so I'll see him. I'll see Barbara Madsen. She's unopposed. That's another issue. I mean, should judges be running unopposed? There should be other people in there mixing it up a little bit with everybody. But anyway, Court of Appeals, that's District 1. Division 2, District 1 is up for grabs. No, I don't think any Superior Court judges are up, no. And a couple of District Court spots, although mostly unopposed. That's interesting. I worry sometimes. I shouldn't say that. I mean, the people who are unopposed are ecstatic. They're saying, hey, we're unopposed. People must love us. So I don't know if that's the case or not, but there's one district court race up, and then the Supreme Court is for all of us. In any county, we're going to be choosing between the incumbent Richard Sanders and the opponent Charlie Wiggins. And so you want to get some information on those guys. Take a look at the site. If you go to the Supreme Court, there's a tab for Supreme Court. You'll see them. And then if you tap on each person, you'll get a rundown. So here's Richard Sanders talks about his legal judicial experience, community service. Then he has a statement. And then there's also a link to the voter's guide. And there are candidate ratings. Look at this. Organizations that are rating the judges. In fact, here's where it shows King County Bar, Tacoma, Pierce County Bar, Municipal League, the Joint Asian Judicial Evaluations Committee, and so forth. Go through that, and you'll see how they're rating the candidates. That'll help you a little bit. And then you look at the newspapers. You know, this morning, in fact, I noticed, I think it was this morning, in the paper or online, I noticed that the Seattle Times, I think it was the Seattle Times, had withdrawn its endorsement of Richard Sanders and moved it over to Charlie Wiggins. Interesting. So you want to take a peek at that as to why they are doing it, what they're doing. A little bit of controversy going on now with some comments made by Justice Jim Johnson and Justice Richard Sanders about folks being in prison and why they're there and so forth. So you want to track that down and make up your own mind. Decide what you're going to do. But this is a permanent website. This is not here just for this particular race. I mean, you've got all this information all the time. So whenever we have a judicial election, you can stop by votingforjudges.org and pick up all this great information. Media stories, ratings and endorsements, all the information about the election of judges. And that's going to help a lot. I would also encourage us all to attend the various candidate forums that go on and to ask questions. Maybe you want to think about your question ahead of time, write it down. Maybe you're going to think about it as you're listening to them. But ask questions, and if they can't answer for some reason, you've asked, you know, how are you going to rule on my case, Judge? They're not going to be able to answer that one, by the way. But if you've asked an inappropriate question, you know, it's okay. They just will tell you that, I'm sorry, I can't answer that. And you can evaluate that, too, I guess. You can say, okay, does that make sense that they're saying that? And but you can ask all kinds of questions. Any question is open to the candidates, and listen to the answer. And then listen to what their opponent has to say. So it's really important stuff. And I worry so much about us not doing enough when it comes to the judicial races. We need to spend some time thinking about them, because those folks do affect us a lot. You remember the recent metadata case where, as part of the case, they're going into somebody's house and taking a peek at their computer. That was a 5-4 decision. And I would have voted with the 4, by the way, and would not have gone with the majority. Maybe if we'd voted some differently at the election, maybe it would have been 5-4 the other way. Maybe you like it the way it is. I don't know. But you need to think about it and recognize that it really is important, and we need to get out and vote in general, but we also need to vote intelligently and look at what we're doing in the judicial races. Very, very important. So be sure to email questions into us, by the way, during the week. You can email them to Jeff. Jeff is our fabulous engineer producer, and you can reach Jeff at jeff@bobpittman.com. So be sure to send in questions during the week, and Jeff will get them lined up for our program each and every Wednesday, 3 p.m. But let's, Diane's joined us for a second, and let's say hi to Diane first.
Hi. I just want to compliment you. It's a little early, but I do like your Halloween costume this year.
Hey, this is good. You know, Halloween is the lawyer's holiday. Few people know that. People who know me, of course, know that it's the lawyer's holiday. And, of course, I'll be going as an attorney. And I always ask, you know, what's scarier than an attorney? And think about an attorney coming up to your door on Halloween, looking for candy, allegedly. You know, I've got to check this out. I caught a note from a colleague over on Facebook, by the way. We do have a Facebook page. Just look for Legal Line with Bob Pittman and join us on Facebook, too. We're having fun over there. But I caught a note, and I haven't looked at the full article yet, but it was saying that some places have passed laws about the age for going out and trick-or-treating. And someone over a certain age will not be able to trick-or-treat legally. And so this may hurt the lawyers because, you know, we depend on Halloween. It's a big event for lawyers. Anyway, all right, so go ahead.
Well, we had several questions coming in this week about living trusts, and since that's your main focus of practice, I guess people feel compelled to question you about that. So,
well, estate planning would be the field.
Yeah. So can you just give us some comments about the use of living trusts, when you might or when you should use them?
And good question.
Our listeners will be...
Yeah, interesting. People have been asking a lot about that. And years ago, I thought, gee, this question will kind of fade away, but it hasn't. And you go way back, go back in the way back machine, the time machine, go back to 1965. Oh, that's a long ways back. But go back to 1965, and you find a book called How to Avoid Probate by Norman Dacey. Now, not many people will remember Norman Dacey. Dacey actually died, by the way, I think about 1994. But he wrote a book that was very controversial at the time. In fact, he was under attack, wild attacks, and he was actually, I forget which state it was, but he was sued successfully. And I think the Supreme Court declined to take the case, leaving the judgment to stand. But he was accused of the unauthorized practice of law. How dare he? And he was quite a character. Wrote this book talking about avoiding probate. I mean, that is just very controversial at the time. In fact, I remember many years ago, obviously before he died, I had a chance to interview Norman Dacey. He was not quite a criminal, I guess, but I don't really mean that, but he had this renegade status, and he was traveling the country. I think he actually had moved to Ireland, if I recall correctly, and he was traveling the country in this van, and I had tracked him down because I wanted to find out, you know, actually ask him about the book and so forth, and he agreed to an interview. I had to meet him in the parking lot of a mall. And there was an appointed time, and I went to the parking lot, and there was his van that he was traveling around in. So I got in the van. I got in the back of the van with him and had my tape recorder. It was real tape back then. And tape recorded an interview that we then aired the following Saturday when I was doing the weekend program. But anyway, the controversy has always been, and I don't think it should be so controversial, quite frankly, but the controversy has always been about, should we be avoiding probate? And probate is made out to be this nightmare, horrible process that is going to eat you alive, and doggone it, we better avoid it at all costs. And it's just a bunch of attorneys ripping off the public, making lots of money. That's the gist of it. And now once in a while, we run across one of those guys or those gals who are out there doing bad things, and it does happen, but not very often. If you look at the reality of probate in a state like Washington, it's a very kind of almost humdrum, boring almost process Superior Court. It's always, in, at least in Washington, always in the Superior Court, which is the regular trial court for the for our court system here in Washington, and that's true generally across the country. And it's just this very boring process of taking the will in, having the court kind of bless the will, say, yep, looks like a will to me. Any objections by anybody? And of course, there typically are no objections. So the will is admitted to probate, stuck in a file, in other words, a probate file. And then we proceed to do things like publish a notice in the newspaper that nobody reads, typically, three times. And we're looking for creditors. We're saying, hey, let's get those creditors in here so we can pay them. And so we publish a notice in the newspaper three times. We try to contact any creditors we know about. And then we start to organize the assets together that belong to the person who died. And we eventually distribute them to the people named in the will as the beneficiaries. And I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 months, maybe 9 months later, everything spits out and the probate is over. And in Washington, it's hard to say exactly what it's going to cost, and the reason is it's not based on any kind of a percentage fee like it is in California, where you actually pay a percentage of the estate as your attorney's fees. And I could become a very wealthy person being a probate attorney down in California, I think, but might have to leave my conscience at the border, I guess, or something. That's unkind, isn't it? But in Washington, you know, a lot of times over the years, I've seen probates run, you know, a couple thousand dollars to $5,000, a lot of them in that range. A few of them will reach up into the 10,000 plus area. If there's a controversy going on, a contest or something like that, you'll see higher numbers, but there probably would be a contest or controversy no matter what method you were using, because it means that people are probably mad at each other and they're working each other over, which does happen from time to time, as we see, you know, hear about cases in the news. Leona Helmsley, remember, left quite a bit of money. I forget how much, a couple million dollars or more, to her dog, appropriately named Trouble. And that caused all kinds of trouble, and there were months and months in litigation. And, of course, who wins when there's litigation? Let me think. I know there was a rule about this. Oh, yeah, the lawyers win when there's litigation. I'm endearing myself to my lawyer colleagues today, aren't I? But at any rate, so this probate goes on. We have some costs. The costs are typically not enormous, at least here in Washington. What I find people objecting about with probate is what I call the hassle factor. And I've got to get Jeff to work on this, a little hassle factor meter. And we take this meter and we apply it against anything we're doing. Like, you know, it's a hassle sometimes to have to get up in the morning. So there's the hassle factor meter. You remember the old view meters from old tape recorders and stuff, you know, and you'll see them bounce, the needle bounces around, it gets into the red zone, you begin to worry a little bit. Well, if we applied the hassle factor meter to a probate, it's going to be off in the red zone, mainly because nobody really wants to do it. You've had someone die in your life, and you just want to kind of, you'd like them back, usually. You'd like them back if you could get them back, and you really don't want to have to go through anything. But you're stuck doing this crazy probate process, and so the hassle factor meter punches you over into the red zone for a while, and you're just annoyed all the time about it, and you say, can't it be done now? Why is it going on? And what was it you said about those stupid notices again? I mean, blah, you know, just awful, blah, blah, blah. It's just kind of annoying, and it's a big hassle. It's not a nightmare, typically, not a nightmare, and certainly not a legal nightmare, but it is a big hassle. And a lot of lawyers don't like to recognize real life, you know, and the real life for the person going through it is they're annoyed and they don't like it very much. It is not a legal nightmare, though. So you may want to think about avoiding probate because of the hassle factor. It might be the privacy factor. Now, probates are public. It's a public process. It used to be we had to actually put in a list of all the assets. That was great. We don't have to do that anymore unless someone requests it. And usually nobody requests it. It could happen. But the document itself, the will is there, the notices that have gone out and copy of the notice in the newspaper, information on the heirs, address information, I guess, for them, all the stuff that's gone on is going to sit in the file other than an actual inventory of the assets. So all the details in the will are going to be a matter of public record. Now, sometimes people are putting things in their will that are fairly private. You know, they're maybe setting up a trust for one of the kids. Maybe they are leaving assets to somebody and they really don't want the world to know that they're leaving assets to this person. Maybe, who knows what it is? Maybe there are kids that nobody else knows about that are being mentioned. So there are sometimes some kind of private matters that are going on inside a will, and you would prefer to keep them private. Now, when I say it's public, that means that you can go down to the courthouse, pick your courthouse, any county in the state, go into the clerk of the Superior Court and say, hey, Bob says I could look at probate files. Is that okay? And they're going to look, and they'll probably say, oh, no, not Bob again. He's sending people out to look at probate files. Okay, who do you want to see, and what do you want to look at? And you can say, well, give me all the probates, the files from last week. Now, in a big county, that's probably going to be a lot of files. But you can take those and kind of move over to the table nearby and sit down there and take a look at all the stuff that's in the files. And you can go back up to the counter and say, hey, I'd like to get a copy of this one because it looks like an intriguing one. Maybe you're a shark or a vulture and you want to find out more information about somebody, and you're going to use it to maybe try to work somebody over, try to get a deal on some of the property. Maybe you know the person has a business or owns a lot of property or something. So that's all public information. And sometimes people object to that and they say, well, you know, I don't want that to be public. Now, keep in mind that most probates are going to sit down there and hardly anybody's ever going to look at them. So I don't want to overstate the concern, but it is a concern for some people. And I think particularly when there are provisions in the will that you really don't want the world to know about or see. Not that it's anything illegal, but you just want to keep it kind of private and to yourself. So privacy factor, cost factor, hassle factor. And on the cost factor for a moment, if you have out-of-state property, so if you own that condo in Hawaii, you own that second home or lot down in Arizona, you've got the Florida swampland or something, and you've got the desert land somewhere too, whatever it might be, you're typically going to have a probate in all the states where you own real estate. Some exceptions, but for the most part, you'll have a probate in every one. Now, that is a reason to avoid probate. Having two or more probates seems really annoying and can be pretty costly. So if you have out-of-state property, it's an indicator right away that you need to think about a living trust. But if you're concerned about privacy, concerned about the hassle factor, you just want things to be ridiculously simple for the survivors, then you're going to look at something called a revocable living trust. And what we're doing in that revocable living trust, picture it as kind of a company that you're creating. Artificial entity, a little company, the Boeing Company, Microsoft, those are companies. So think of a little company that you're creating. It's called a trust, and you're going to put all your assets in the trust. So Bob and Diane's house is going to, instead of it saying Bob and Diane Pittman, husband and wife, it's going to say something like Bob and Diane Pittman, trustees of the Pittman Family Trust. So we're going to have a bank account in the name of our trust. We're going to have a brokerage account in the name of our trust. So we're going to generally move our assets into the name of this little trust, this little company that we've created. We're going to be the trustees. That's like being the president, co-presidents of the company. Remember, I don't know if they still do it, but it seems to me Nordstrom's for a while had like co-presidents and co-this, and I don't know how that ever worked out. I haven't heard if they're still doing that or not. But that's what you're doing. You're kind of in charge of your trust. You are in charge of your trust, as the trustee. If you're by yourself, it's just you. If it's with a partner or spouse, you're going to have co-trustees typically, and you're going to each be trustees of the trust. When something happens, so Bob dies first, Diane just is the trustee. There's no probate to go through. Everything is in the trust or directed to the trust or has a place to go. And so Diane doesn't have to go through the probate process. She continues on with the living trust. So all those hassles of the probate are going to go away. Now, there are always things you have to do when somebody dies. Nothing is ever just automatic. So got to do a few things. Got to notify some people that Bob is gone now. Got to call the Bar Association and say, hey, you're not going to be getting any dues from Bob anymore. He's gone. And I don't think he's coming back, near as we can tell. So you got to. There's always stuff you got to do when there's a death. And maybe there's some tax stuff you have to do, estate tax issues that have to be addressed, and we can talk about those on a different occasion. And the estate tax stuff is usually involving some form of a trust, another trust that gets created at the time of the death of the first spouse or the partner. And so you've got your just a few miscellaneous things that have to go on, but otherwise the survivor is just kind of going on. And down the road, when the survivor passes away, like in our case, now we've lost Bob and Diane, well, things are going to drift down in the trust to the heirs of the trust, the descendants, might be the kids. It's going to be more or less automatic. A little bit of help from a lawyer and an accountant, but it's pretty straightforward. There's not that probate process to go through. So you're making things really simple and easy, typically, for the survivors. Now, I mentioned that you have to put your stuff in the trust. That is critical. Sometimes people don't put all their stuff in the trust, or they forget, or they go buy something and they forget to put it in the name of the trust. And then there may have to be a probate still what's called a pour-over will. That's the document. It's a traditional will, but all it says in that will is, hey, everything goes to my trust. So if you have to go through a probate, you're just going to probate the items that got left out, and there's no information in the probate file about the trust other than the name of the trust. So all the details are kept private. So I've even seen people that do a living trust and have a pour-over will and say, I don't care if we go through probate or not, and I'm not going to fund my trust. I'm going to go through probate, but I'm going to maintain privacy. And so that's okay, too. So the probate factor is one. The incapacity issue is something that people don't usually talk about when it comes to revocable living trusts. But if you end up, and not everybody will, but if you end up in a long-term incapacity, awful stuff, long-term incapacity, then if you have a revocable living trust, the assets, your assets, are going to be managed through the trust. And the trust is a superior vehicle to a durable power of attorney, in my opinion, for long-term management of assets. The durable power of attorney is still going to be needed for something like an IRA account, because the IRA is not going to reside inside the trust, the retirement account. So you still need to have the durable general power of attorney, and you still need to have a durable power of attorney for health care. That can't be done through the trust. You can pay the bills through the trust, but you can't exercise or make health care decisions within a trust. That's got to be a durable power of attorney for health care. So there's still other things that you need, but the incapacity issue, and I like to talk about the what about me stuff. So if I'm incapacitated, I want to have the right TV show on. I want to have the right books being read to me, or I guess I can do that on the iPod now, right? I want the right music. I don't want certain things done. I want the right food and stuff. If I can't communicate very well and I'm incapacitated, some people would say that's now, but anyway, if I'm incapacitated, I want people to use my trust and the assets to do the right things for me and run the right music and the right TV and all that. And, I might just stick around for a while. It's going to, hang out and take advantage of all that kind of stuff. So if you're not breathing life into your documents, and you're not doing things like the "what about me" information, then you're not doing real planning. So we're going to a lot of times base this on a revocable living trust platform to gain privacy, keep things pretty hassle-free, and address that dreaded incapacity issue. And, oh, yes, we're going to avoid probate, which is kind of nice, but it's not the main focus of quality revocable trust planning. I like to see revocable trust planning done in a guidebook format. I like things to be ridiculously simple. And let's face it, legal documents are not, they don't come across as ridiculously simple. So we include them in a guidebook format, typically. And the guidebook is just that. It's really simple stuff, by the way, the guidebook stuff. It's organizing all your documents together in the big red book, we call it. We should do a picture of this and put it on the website, by the way, a picture of a guidebook. We should do that. We'll have to work on that. Jeff, make a note. we'll work on maybe doing a picture of what a guidebook actually looks like. Anyway, the big red book, all the junk is in there. The healthcare powers of attorney, the trust, the will, the you name it. All this stuff is inside there, along with lots of explanatory material. Here's a healthcare power of attorney. Here's why it's here. Here's what it's for. I guess you might be able to figure that one out. But all the information is in there about what does this mean? What do I actually do? If Bob is incapacitated, what do I actually have to think about doing? And so that's in there. And I find that is comforting when there's a disaster. And let's face it, when someone dies or becomes incapacitated, it's kind of a disaster. And all of a sudden we're in disaster mode. And we're just running around saying, oh my goodness, what am I supposed to do now? Well, if you can grab onto the guidebook and say, okay, at least I know how to get started. I've got some directions in here. I got the documents. You know, if someone calls and says, hey, Bob's in the hospital, get down here and bring the healthcare power of attorney, you know, where are you going to look for it? Where are you going to look for it? Well, you're going to maybe just grab the big red book and head on down to the hospital. And even if he can't see straight, hopefully he had someone else drive, by the way, but even if he can't see straight, you can point out and say, it's in there. And someone behind the desk can open up the big red book, and they'll find the tab that says healthcare powers. They'll flip open to that, and they'll say, aha, healthcare power of attorney. They'll open up the little three-ring binder arrangement, take it out, photocopy it, stick it back in the book, and either hold it until you're feeling better or hand it back to you. And you're operational. So the idea is to take all the documents that you've carefully put together and put them in an easygoing guidebook format. Make it simple. Make it easy as possible. And even then, it's going to be awful because awful things happen at some point, whether it's a death, an incapacity, whatever it might be. Awful stuff turns up from time to time. You want to be prepared. Now, I want to bring up one point that I always like to talk about. When you're passing assets downstream, down to the next generation maybe, or the heirs, the kids, the grandchildren, whoever is out there who's going to be taking your stuff when you're done, think about putting Saran wrap around the assets when you pass it out. Think about passing these assets out in a special kind of a trust. This is whether you're using a will or a living trust to get there, but a special kind of lifetime flexible trust arrangement. And what you're doing is you're offering the next gang, the next group there who's going to take hold of your assets, you're offering them asset protection. You're offering them protection from divorces and lawsuits and all the awful stuff that sometimes turns up in someone's life. I've had a number of calls over the years from kids. They're sometimes adult children who are inheriting assets from mom and dad, and they're in trouble, some kind of trouble. Maybe it's a bankruptcy going on. Maybe it's a lawsuit. Maybe it's a divorce. Whatever it is, they're concerned, am I going to lose my inheritance? And if mom and dad or Uncle Buck and Aunt Jane have put Saran wrap around the assets before passing them out, In other words, put them in a special version of a lifetime trust share, very carefully crafted together because it's going to last a lifetime. So this is not a quick little two-page document. But if they put it into a very flexible lifetime trust arrangement with all the right terms and conditions and all the right stuff, you can protect the next generation from lawsuits and divorces in general. And that is worthwhile planning. It's at least worthwhile to think about it and decide whether it's appropriate for you. And I can tell you, people who have had it and have had disasters occur would generally say, boy, I'm glad Mom and Dad did that because that's all I've got left. I lost all my other assets, but I have my inheritance. And thanks, Mom and Dad. They take extra flowers out to your gravesite if you have a gravesite. So, you know, that's another issue. A lot of people are dumping their ashes out in Puget Sound and stuff, or Ganges River and all these other places, and there's no place for the kids or anybody to go. I don't know what is that an issue? I don't know. What, Diane, what do you think? Do you think it's nice for people to have some kind of a memorial spot, do you think?
Yeah, some place for the kids to remember or to gather or to have your mark in life.
Seems like it. I mean, I guess you wouldn't even have to be there if you were. I guess you could have your ashes dumped out somewhere, I guess. And I don't know. But it almost seems like, and that's just an interesting, I mean, it's all personal choice stuff, but, you know, brings up another issue, and that is that we should all be thinking about our memorial. I mean, what is it that we want? And be respectful, I think, of family members too and what they would want. But what is it that you do want? You know, and how would you like to be remembered? And maybe think about whether you're going to do, you know, some kind of a traditional burial where there's a gravesite and stuff. We were out a while back to the National Cemetery. Wow, what a nice place. Those folks do a class A job. Out at the, and I'm sure that's true across the country, that all the national cemeteries, what an operation. And they do a great job of getting folks sent off to wherever they're going and take care of the loved ones who are left. And sometimes they're out there waiting for the loved ones to to end up out there too, I guess. But it is a really neat place. If you get a chance to visit a national cemetery, I would sure recommend that. All right. What we'll do is we'll watch for more questions. You can email your questions, remember, during the week to Jeff, and it's just jeff@bobpittman.com. You can give us a call during the program. We air 3 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can give a call at 253-471-9694. You can, of course, we invite everybody to visit the archives. And we're keeping the light on. The archives are going to fill up, and we're going to make sure that they're like really, it's really a pleasant place to visit. And so, you know, we'll keep the lights there, and we won't make it so you feel frightened to go into the archive room. But we're going to have things there. We've got the featured broadcast right now is a fun one, interview of Gary Alexander, Justice Gary Alexander, who is now the former Chief Justice, but continues as a justice of the Supreme Court, Washington State Supreme Court. Fun interview. You want to listen in on that one. And there's some other fun ones there. The Pledge of Allegiance behind barbed wire. Sure invite people to stop by and listen to Mako Nakagawa talk about how she learned the Pledge of Allegiance from behind barbed wire. We're working on a number of different fun projects that are going to be coming up. We are going to be looking for you each and every week, of course, at 3 o'clock Wednesday afternoons at bobpittman.com. I want to remind everybody to get out and vote. I mean, it is just critical. It's always critical. It seems even more critical right now that we get out and vote. There are lots of interesting things on the ballot, initiatives, strange stuff, interesting stuff. You know, I'll say be sure to take time to vote for the judges. Visit the votingforjudges.org website, please. And keep it in mind for the future. This is here, so the next time around when we have judicial elections, you'll be able to go there and take a look at votingforjudges.com and learn a little bit about the judges. And then I challenge everybody to visit and attend a candidates forum. Judicial Candidates Forum and ask a question. Yeah, it's if you're thinking of it, then probably someone else in the audience is thinking about it too, but maybe they're afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Even though these are maybe incumbent judges and would-be judges, ask them questions. They're people too, and they're just attorneys who are trying to become a judge or have become a judge, but you never know. It could be Bob. There's a Bob person up there. So ask questions. It's okay to do that. Be sure to ask us questions as well. So we're going to slip out for this week. We want to thank everybody for joining us each and every week here at BobPittman.com. This is Bob Pittman for the Legal Line Network.